This is a Media Lab podcast. Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. Can you believe it? We're almost in the folly season. Way back in May, we started with Beautiful Girls, and now we're here making our own music. But I still have a few episodes planned, even after we've talked about the finale. This week, I have the ultra-talented Colin Molloy on as a guest. He'll fill you in on everything that he does in a moment, but something we didn't discuss when we recorded with each other a few months ago is that he worked on a musical called A Threshold. He wrote the music and lyrics, and the audio of that show was released onto the internet back in July. So I'm going to include that in the show notes because I was a fan of it, and I think that you should check it out. Also, as a slight little tangent, and maybe this is just me being too self-deprecating, but it continually inspires me that so many great people who are working on so many fun and great things and are, you know, just talented and great at what they do, want to be guests on this show, some dumb Canadian guy with a podcast. So I'm thankful for everyone who wants to come on here and talk about Sondheim with me. Now, because we go through Sondheim's show chronologically, up next, as you might suspect, is A Little Night Music. What I want to know from you is which productions are your favorite. Of course, I'll be using the original Broadway cast, but I'd love to know other productions that are must listens in your opinion. So send those to me via Twitter, Instagram, or you can send an email to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. And I also need to thank my lovely patrons, including a new supporter. Thank you, Gail, for donating to the show. This is a good step to make this an entirely fan-supported show. I also need to give a huge thanks to the God That's Good tier, the Holy Triumvirate, as I keep calling them. Jack, Todd, and Barry, thank you for your kind donations. But now, it's time for Plodding Along. Plotting Along is the part of the show where I describe to you what is happening in the plot. So we're still inside the Psycho Follies. Each core character has had a chance to have their solo, and now it is finally Ben's turn. This is how the 1987 version of Follies ends, with Ben putting on one last show to convince people that all you need in order to be successful is to write your own music. We'll see if that's a winning strategy. Okay, let me go thank some sponsors, and when I return, it'll be my conversation with Colin Molloy about make the most of your music. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by the Calgary Foundation. Whether it's funding anti-racism programs, addiction recovery, or food hampers for the hungry, for 65 years, the Calgary Foundation has proudly supported the charitable community to address some of Calgary's biggest challenges. Now, during this period of unprecedented urgent needs, Calgary Foundation renewed its commitment to building a healthy, vibrant, giving, caring, and resilient community. If you're a registered charity looking for a grant, a professional advisor creating a giving plan for your client, or a donor wanting to give back to community, discover a wealth of resources at calgaryfoundation.org and learn more about their work through Calgary Foundation's Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. This episode of Putting It Together is also brought to you by Park Power, a provider of electricity and natural gas in Alberta that offers low rates, awesome service, and profit sharing for local charities. In Alberta, you get to choose who to buy your energy from. If you switch retailers, nothing changes about the delivery of electricity or natural gas to your home or business. If you have an existing contract, you're going to want to find out the terms for leaving. If you don't, then it's even easier to sign up for Park Power. The choice is yours. And there's a better deal available to you. Learn more at parkpower.ca.
How do you come? out of damningly humble beginnings and get to be me.
Colin Malloy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, because you're a new guest here on the show, I would love it if you just took a moment and explained who you are and what it is that you do.
I am a composer lyricist. I live in London, though not at the moment. I'm in the north of England with my partner in Sheffield, which is a nice, very cozy city. That is kind of what I do. I'm mostly a musician. I work in a couple of schools. I play the piano quite a lot. But I guess I'm a fairly recent university graduate and trying to make my way as a young composer writing musicals.
I mean, I don't necessarily want to the negativity of anything like this, but what do you feel is the future of composer lyricists in Britain?
Oh, yikes.
Or is that even something you think about? Is this something that you want to do more worldwide?
Oh, I mean, yeah, that's probably putting a finer point in it. I think the way the world is now, everyone is we're all connected in terms of technology, and it makes sense to have worldwide ambitions in that sense. But in terms of the landscape in the UK, I tend to see America and that side of the world as leagues ahead, and you've got so much, you know, funding for musical theatre, and not to be a Debbie Downer about everything, but things seem so great at the other side of the water than they are here sometimes. You know, there's a nice community here, and there are lots of young writers, and not young, but starting out writers who are excited in challenging the form, and lots of people are into their Sondheim, which is good, and trying to continue that legacy and make interesting stuff.
You know, this might be the wrong metaphor, but was there a gateway drug that got you into wanting to write your own music?
It definitely was Mr. Sondheim, that well-frequented drug, which happened when I was about 14 or 15. I used to be a dancer, and this is a long backstory, which we needn't go into, but I used to be a dancer, and then I focused my attentions on being a musician as a pianist and the violinist. And I was into theatre. I liked doing the school musical and acting and that, and that was fun. But I wouldn't say that I loved musicals. I think I liked West Side Story, but that was about it. And then when I was 14, in one of the bookshops near home, I saw Finishing the Hat, and it said Stephen Sondheim. And I thought, oh, he's the guy who wrote the lyrics for West Side Story. And I kind of flicked through the book, and I looked at the West Side Story chapter, and I managed to convince my dad to pay however much it was to buy the book with the full knowledge that I would just read this West Side Story chapter, and that would be it, because I was obsessed with Leonard Bernstein. So I bought the book, read that chapter, and thought, well, that was fun. Let's look at another chapter. And I turned to Company, and this sounded so weird and so interesting. I thought, this musical where nothing really happens and this guy goes and visits people. So I would sit at home with my laptop watching productions of Company whilst I had the book there, reading the lyrics and just trying to assimilate and understand what was going on. And I went nuts for it, and I just ticked them off one by one and went through all of the shows and tried to find high school productions of Sondheim shows, which for the most part, all bad.
Love that high school production of Company, though. They really nail that existential dread of a mid-30s guy. that is a little bit wild to me. I mean, this is my own prejudice coming into play here, which is supposition here is always that Company is the one that you come to later in life when you're a young person. It's usually not the one that you like get into right at the beginning. Can you, I don't know, put into words why you think it was Company that really grabbed your interest?
I mean, I don't want to say I see myself in Robert, but I'm a quiet person, and I tend to be a bit of an observer, and I watch from the wayside. I like to watch other people do stuff and learn from their mistakes or their fortunes. And I think the production I watched first was the 2006 revival with Raul Espaza.
Right.
And I think the fact that they were playing instruments as well, and I was a musician, I thought, this is amazing. This is really first rate stuff. And then when you figure out it's not the first time it's been done, there are my dreams crushed. I could have seen Patrick Home playing the tuba.
Where did Follies come in? Did you do it like in chronological order, or did you kind of bounce around in the book?
You know, I can't remember, but I don't think Follies was far off. Actually, at the time, I was learning The Man I Love on the piano. I was learning some Gershwin transcriptions, I remember. And I think it must have been around the same time that I listened to the 2011 revival cast recording with Bernadette Peters, and I then put two and two together, or at least I must have read somewhere that The Man I Love and Losing My Mind, well, Losing My Mind is a pastiche of The Man I Love, which right. is great when you're learning that piano piece and you think, oh, they're related in some way. So that's how I got into it. And then I went to see, there was a concert staging at the Royal Albert Hall in 2015, which I went to see, and it was, without meaning to be too offensive, not great. I didn't really enjoy it at all. They put an interval at the end of Too Many Mornings, which I know was the done thing in the past. But I really wasn't enamored by anything. They had this huge stellar cast, and it was absolutely packed and had an amazing orchestra, but I just was left feeling cold by it. And I probably, looking back now, I think I was, I think, just 18, so I don't think I really understood probably what was going on. I probably didn't even care. I don't think I'd even been in a relationship before, so, you know, there's not much to know there. But then after that, I started to find ways to listen to the other existing casting recordings. I listened to the original, which is interesting despite the problems it has. I listened to the 1985 Avery Fisher Hall recording, which is brilliant, and then discovered the 1998 Paper Mill Playhouse one. And I'm a bit of a completist, so being able to hear all of the songs, and I think I bought the score around the same time too, and having the opportunity to look at the lyrics, have the score, and listen to all of the songs without interruption was kind of bliss. And then fortunately in 2017 the National Theatre decided to revive it, and I went and saw it 5 times.
You know what's so funny, I've had a few people on now that have seen that version, like got to go to it live, and the same thing, they go to it multiple times, they liked it that much. I've only been able to see the, of course, the recorded version of it, which I also quite like, but I'm sure it's a different different thing to be in the audience.
I think that was quite a special production as well, and it's nice to see it from different angles, you know, go from the see it from the gods and then see it in the front row is special. I feel really bad now that you've not seen it in the flesh.
Yeah, I know. Before we go too far, I just have to say this because I need to. The debate about where or if there should be a intermission in Follies is quite a big one online, I find.
Yeah, that's never a good place, I don't think. Actually, I think the Royal Albert Hall, they did it just before. Yes, this is it. I remember they did it just before Loveland. So
That's weird.
You have the music leading up to it, and then I think they paused, and the idea was, oh, come back after your pee break and we'll be in Loveland.
Follies is something you kind of grew into loving, or was it you liked it and then you were trying to find the production that you could really identify with?
Yeah, I liked it for the music primarily, and then the songs. I think there are some really witty things in there, and I guess as a composer myself, I really respected how well Sondheim could pastiche, and he's not even pastiching an era. Each song is a deliberate pastiche of a specific composer. And I think anyone who can be that detailed with what they're doing in terms of following phrase structures of Gershwin or harking back to old operetta forms, I think is really, really spectacular. And I think I liked it for that reason, first of all. And then I think as I grew into it and I started listening to the lyrics more, I realized, oh, there really is some kind of emotional payoff with these songs. And then as you begin to kind of scout YouTube and you see all the videos of people performing it, you realize this is really good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. People are going to know that I'm a broken record on this because I've said this now a few times. I think the bonkers thing is how Sondheim says, like, he's doing this pastiche, obviously, and it's like, I'm using this composer's music, but then this other composer's lyrics, and then kind of mashing them together. I'm like, I don't even know how your mind kind of goes into that. It's like, obviously this is Gershwin with Lorenz Hart lyrics. I'm like, sure. I can hear the music easier than I can, like, pick out, like, lyric choices and stuff like that, I think.
I think it makes it easier as a composer to limit yourself to, okay, I'm going to be in this head. He's acting in a sense. I mean, he's a bastard for that. Today I'm going to be Franz Lehár and Tim Rice. No one wants to hear that song, but
but he could do it if he wanted to.
He could.
Okay, well, we're going to be talking about this kind of weirder song that has only, as far as I understand it, in the 1987 London version. I don't think another version of Follies has actually done this, called Make the Most of Your Music. Now, I know between us talking here already, beforehand, you have a bit of a relationship with the 1987 London version. I'm wondering if you expand on that a bit.
A relationship in that I kind of try and avoid it as when I can. It's so peculiar, I think, and there's so little written about it in terms of why Cameron McIntosh wanted Sondheim to write these four extra songs. It seems to me, from what I read, you can correct me if I'm wrong, in that for that production there were fewer chorus girls, or that there must have been a smaller chorus. So I believe so,
yeah.
They were relying on, rather than, whereas in Live, Laugh, Love there is a chorus accompanying Ben, it seems like this is more of a, this is just Ben singing song. And the chorus chime in towards the end.
Not to interrupt too much here, but the other thing that Cameron McIntosh is weird about, because I forget what interview I was reading or watching, but he even mentions the fact that, like, he had heard about Sondheim, he was getting into producing, of course, and then that first production of Company in 1971 comes over, and he doesn't like it. Like, he didn't like Company at all, but then still wanted to work with Sondheim for Follies, because he knew, like, people loved it over in America. Anyways, he's an interesting dude.
He is on the trend, as always. So I think it comes from a I can see where it happens from a pragmatic point of view. But then what's bizarre is that it's been however many, 16 years since the original production of Follies. There was some kind of, well, I'm sure there must, was there a revival before the 1985?
Not a full revival. Yeah. So 1985, they did that like concert studio album version with like the all-star cast. But I'm pretty sure the 1987 London version is the first like full production revival that happened.
Interesting. And it's kind of like this stuff has been around for years. And yet, in spite of that, Cameron wants to do this. And it's fine. It's, you know, sometimes he can write songs, he can churn out some stuff. But
Well, I think it is. And I think what they're trying to do is have like a quote unquote happier ending, even with it ending in despair. But they're trying to have like they're kind of trying to couch it. So that's kind of to spoil the lead here, is I feel that it's not as honest as what the original Follies is, because they're trying to be a happier kind of like denouement to the whole thing. To that point as well, is that I also think you can tell that this is Sondheim in the late 80s writing it for a show that happened in 1971.
Absolutely.
Like he just had a different style. It's like, oh, that seems like Into the Woodsy, like Sunday in the Park with George, more than it sounds like Follies does.
You're completely right. And I think I can definitely hear that when you listen to Country House. The texture is, I mean, it's a great song. I don't think the song justifies itself in being there, but the texture is so much sparser. The orchestrations are really nice, and it's still the same creative team in terms of music, but it definitely does sound like the sound world of Into the Woods. And
it's a weird beast. So this song in the 1987 version essentially replaces Live, Laugh, Love, although they have kind of rejiggered like a bunch of different songs around here at the ending point. But that's essentially what it's doing. It's the Ben song of him in the Follies now, in the Psycho Follies, as Sondheim likes to call this section. What they're doing here is they are using classical composers, at least at the intro to this song, to bring him in. Here's the thing, and I know we've already talked about this off mic, but I think it's very obvious what Grieg piece we're talking about. I'm not 100% on which Tchaikovsky piece it is, so hopefully people will write in and tell me what it is that they're referencing. This is what I figured out. So the first bit is very obviously Grieg's Piano Concerto in A minor.
Yes.
I looked at Tchaikovsky piano concertos, I will say not deeply, I kind of like fast forwarded and tried to see if I could find sections. The only one that kind of sounds like it is his piano concerto 1 in B flat minor. But that is a bit of a reach, I think. But there's a little bit of a semblance to that too. I should also say that even though it does not appear in the other Follies versions, I'm still going to give credit to all the Bens that we've had that we're looking at this season. So the original Broadway cast is John McMartin. The 1987 Ben is Daniel Massey, and then the 2017 National Theater version is Philip Quast. But Daniel Massey is basically who you'll be hearing in this episode. So this is how it begins, Colin. How do you come out of numbingly humble beginnings and get to be me? How do a few little doodly doodles turn into a beautiful symphony? Can you make what is merely so-so into something big league? Take a tip from a virtuoso, me, Tchaikovsky, and Grieg.
How do you come out of numbingly humble beginnings and get to be me? How do a few little doodly doodles turn into a beautiful symphony? Can you make what is merely so-so into something big league? Take a tip from a virtuoso, me, Tchaikovsky, and Grieg.
So pause there. I want to know, I will say this again is a prejudice of mine. I feel that if it was anyone but Sondheim, I would roll my eyes about doodly doodles being put into a lyric. But what do you think about first opening bit?
I got an instant flashback to when I first listened to it, which gave me a terrible headache. I can't see the premise in the same way that I can with Live, Laugh, Love. And I think even the stretch to Grieg and Tchaikovsky feels so not in sync with the rest of the show, which is referencing, at least if they are operatic, but they're stage composers, if that makes sense. I have small knowledge of what Grieg and Tchaikovsky's output are, but I don't know if they did much stage work. Maybe your followers could correct me.
Yeah.
You're right in that it seems such a reach, and it does get a sympathetic eye roll from me too.
Yeah. I mean, to kind of set the stage here maybe a little bit better is that in the 87 version, Ah But Underneath comes like right before this. And so Phyllis is basically at the very edge of the stage, leaves, and then Ben comes out. So the curtain is actually supposed to be drawn at this point. So he's just in front of a curtain by himself. So this is how he starts, is like in this section here. And then as we go on, you'll see it gets more lavish and opulent as we go through. But that's kind of where we start from, is very bare bones. If I was staging this and the actor could play piano, it would actually make more sense if he was playing the piano at the very beginning. But that's maybe asking too much.
The other thing that really grates on me is, and I love Jonathan Tunick, but this will forever be the one song that I can't stand for. One, only the song's existence. But two, Jonathan Tunick's weird orchestration of adding a kind of synthesized piano sound, which sounds so unrealistic. One, it sounds nothing like the kind of music of the past, and two, that kind of stuff should stay in the 1980s, and I'm glad that song has never really resurfaced, or at least that orchestration has died some kind of terrible death, because it makes my spine crawl.
It's weird. Synthesizers work in a certain type of music, but I'm going to make a stand. I hate it when I hear Broadway scores using synthesized instruments. It just grates on me a little bit. But that might be me being pretentious. I don't know. So that's how we start. Basically, the analogy, of course, being here that he is basically aligning himself with these like two great composers. And we're going to lean into that theme here a little bit more. Here's what the second section sounds like. So he continues on going, what you do is construct yourself by the way you conduct yourself. You don't have to disclose yourself. Compose yourself. Find your tune. Set your key. Clair de lune, it may never be, but make the most of the music that is yours.
What you do is construct yourself by the way you conduct yourself. You don't have to disclose yourself. Compose yourself. Find your tune, set your key. Clair de lune, it may never be, but make the most of the music that is yours.
Can I just tell you? I don't. It's very sweet. I don't know what it is. But it's only in this small section here, a portion that Daniel Massey sounds exactly like Mandy Patinkin does when he portrays the dog in Sunday in the Park with George. It's like the same tone and intonation. I'm like, that's all I can think about when I hear this section, and it's really weird.
What you do is construct yourself by the way you conduct yourself.
Roof! Roof! Thanks! The week has been roof!
As a composer yourself, I want you to maybe jump into like rhyme scheme and how he is actually constructing this song. Like, what do you have to say about that?
It's quite straightforward in terms of structure. It's, we've had that kind of opening intro, and now he's setting up the verse and the basic premise, which is, well, if you're not sure what to say, come up with your own music and, you know, twist it. And it's kind of music play rather than wordplay and, you know, bend the tune. And I can see how that was how that's replaced Live, Laugh, Love. I mean, I like the rhyme Clair de Lune with tune, but again, I don't get the reference in the same. Why are we bringing up Debussy all of a sudden? Am I being really pernickety with that? I don't know.
I think you're right. I mean, so part of it, and this is me going like full-blown English major, which is what I got my degree in, reading of this, is that I think this is supposed to show us like how bit deluded Ben is and how he puts on appearances more than anything. So he knows the words to say and he knows like the great composers. But even when he's saying like, what is the actual lyric here? He says, make the most of the music that is yours. Except at the beginning, he's not using music that's his.
Yeah.
He's entering this song using other people's music and being like, look at how great I am. But he didn't do anything.
Sure. Well, that's a nice irony. But then also, isn't that what Sondheim was doing in writing these songs?
Sure. Yeah. Like using other people's. Yeah. No, that's true. There's like that kind of that double reading. How about the idea of compose? Because I do think that compose is being used in two different ways.
Yeah. I think it is clever that the idea that compose in terms of create your own music, create your own narrative, or create your own way to get through any kind of, you know, in this case with Ben, it's any kind of conversation, if it's name dropping or looking like you are the alpha male of the room. But then it's also the compose, what I imagine, which is putting on the face, or I guess keeping calm. Is that what you would say by the word compose?
Staying composed. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think that's good. I think it's hard because with a song like this, which is quite over and maybe camp in a way, that it's such a subtle word in terms of variation. And I don't know if many people listening to it would necessarily latch onto that in a way that Sondheim wants, but it's fine.
You know, this, it really just reminds me, and it's not this song, I think it is Live, Laugh, Love, actually, that he mentions this in, which is basically supposed to be about a performer rather than a musical style, which was Fred Astaire is who he was kind of emulating in that one.
Sure.
And in this one, I don't know if it's Fred Astaire necessarily, but it feels like a 1940s musical in a way, right? Like, it's not really saying a whole lot. It's just kind of a list of kind of metaphors that all mean the exact same thing. But the music's pretty, and that's kind of all you cared about back then.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So I think that's what this song is supposed to emulate more than anything.
Yeah, I can see that. I like the word conduct more than compose, because that has more of a kind of active quality to it, and how you conduct yourself and in terms of how you behave can also, it's the fun play on words with also being a conductor in that sense of an orchestra. But I wonder if the metaphor lasts too long. I mean, I feel like it's a really long song, but then I listen to Live, Laugh, Love immediately afterwards, and that's just as long. So I don't know how I managed to deal with that.
The beauty with that song, though, is I like what people describe when they see audiences seeing that for the first time and they know what's going to happen, is because people really do think that the actor's forgotten lines.
Yeah.
And then it's like that little bit of like why I think theater has perpetuated, because there is a little bit of danger when you do something live, right? That something can mess up. You don't necessarily want to see it, but it's like there's always that danger there. And so when you see someone in a musical looks like they just like messed up a line, it's like, oh no, this is going off the rails. But this is exactly what the creators wanted in the first place. And yeah, and this one is more like a similar theme and like conduct yourself, always have the right thing to say. But I don't know if it necessarily hits that message as good as what Live, Laugh, Love does.
Yeah, you're right.
So Ben continues on. He says, if your range isn't great, you can change it. Just modulate. Make the most of the music that is yours till it soars. Compose, add to your theme till it grows. Nothing extreme. Say a note of disdain here and there gives the refrain a certain flair. Compose, add to the gleam till it glows, gathering steam with a note of success, flaunt your talents, a note of distress, though distress the balance.
If your range isn't great, you can change it, just modulate. Make the most of the music that is yours, till it's all. Nothing extreme, say a note of disdain here and there gives the refrain a certain flair. Compose, blend it like cream till it flows, gathering steam with a note of success, flaunt your talents, a note of distress though to stress the balance.
Okay, so the part they have to bring up that is different on the actual recording is the point where he says, add to your theme till it grows, nothing extreme. Say a note of disdain. So that section there, in the actual recording, he doesn't say that. He says, blend it like cream till it flows. That yes. is what the recording says. So,
and actually, in the score I have, which is the complete score, it says blend it like cream.
So there you go. So Sondheim mistakenly put in the wrong lyrics in his book. I've put you on blast, Stephen. So yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts on this section?
Well, it's funny because I guess it's he's listing things that as a composer, I definitely it's all of these things that are easier said than done. You think, oh, I'll just add a thing here, or I'll just this tune, I can just add some more notes, I can thicken out this harmony, and then once I've done that, this is going to be so much better. And then you sit down to do it, and I mean, it's fitting because I've been sat with work today and looking at stuff and thinking, all I need to do is add this little thing here, and then you get down and you do it, and it takes 5 hours when you think it's going to take 15 minutes. So it's, and I wonder if that's me having a musical hat on. I can instantly see what he's getting at when he says that these things are easier said than done. But I don't know what impression you get from that. Maybe you might do from your kind of English perspective. I wonder if they can be applied to things like writing an essay or making a cake, or I don't know.
Yeah, I think you can. I think you can make that analogy to any kind of different like artistic output. I think it's very specifically meant to be musical, though. Like he's singing a song, obviously, but he's also already referenced like three different composers. And I think that is what the pervading metaphor is, right? That compose that he constantly brings back, compose, right? Like, I am the conductor of this symphony, so I have to keep putting these like little flourishes here and there. I don't know why I hadn't thought about this before, even though it had been written, whatever, a few years, 3 years, I think, if I'm doing my math right, before this. This is essentially what putting it together is, like putting it together, the song from Sunday, right? It's like, you know, I have to put all this stuff together to make it work. Yeah, so your work can go in exhibition, that sort of thing. It's just kind of a different outlet to that same idea put into this show.
Yeah, and I think with putting it together, there is that progression. It's George thinking about my work, and then it's thinking about how people interpret that work, and then it's, oh my gosh, but what am I? Who am I as an artist? Whereas with Ben and this song, it's, I'm writing a song, and this is all I've got to do. Add some things right, here, right. Add some things there. Song. And it's right. Never that easy, but maybe sometime is, you know, psyching us all out, and that is the general gist of the song, and in which case, props to him.
But you know, I'm not going to ask the hack question about like what comes first, the music or the lyrics, but I do want to know from you as a composer, when do you know it's time to toss something out versus keep it in the song and keep fighting with it to make it work?
I think it's very variable and dependent on the character I'm writing or the project I'm working on, if I'm working with myself or working with a collaborator, and finding that boundary of whether to be good cop or bad cop. And I tend to be bad cop with myself, but perhaps good cop with a collaborator. Mm. If a metaphor isn't going to last you for 3-4 minutes, or if you can't find ways to spin it or reverse it in a way that's not necessarily clever, but subtle or progresses an idea or a thought, then I tend to throw it out. Mm. I think you'd really want something you can squeeze the lemon of, is what I would say.
What do you look for in collaborators, though, when you work with people? How do you work the best with other people?
I think I tend to look for people who have I like people who have the same interests as me in terms of musicals, I guess, or plays in general. I think writing the book of a musical is even harder than writing the music or lyrics. So finding someone who is as selfless as to want to write the book of a musical is someone I look for more than anyone, or someone who doesn't want to, say, necessarily show off what they can do through song, but is fully invested in the character and getting the character across. That's my kind of person. But someone who enjoys the puzzle and the agony of putting things together into a song and making it incredibly clear as to what you're trying to get across, making the song work, justifying itself. Yeah, maybe I am bad cop after all. I mean, I tend to throw so much stuff away. I'm not precious about my stuff. If it doesn't work, right. It's gone. And I'd like people who will tell me, you know, this doesn't work.
I mean, I think that's the brilliance. I think Sondheim mentions that, where he thinks that in a musical, you need three different roles. You need the director, like the choreographer, and the music and lyric team. And it doesn't really work if someone is like the same in one of those two roles. You need the three different perspectives, so it's like, yes, this is going to work, this is not going to work, and you make everyone else kind of become better. Hopefully that's the goal. At least
absolutely.
Ben continues on. He goes, this is going to be a bit of a longer section, but he says, compose, don't lose the pace of your bass notes, and when you have to erase notes, replace them with grace notes. Like a note of wit, to give it style, a note of glitter, a note of guile, a note of tact, a note of friction, a note of fact in amongst the fiction, and to counteract any contradiction, a note or two of complete conviction. Compose, compose, compose. Luscious harp, soft hi-hat. If you're sharp, then you won't fall flat. Make the most of the music that is yours. Give it sweep, add a fill. Give the people a great big trill. Make the most of the music till it soars, till it scores.
Compose, don't lose the pace of your bass notes. And when you have to erase notes, replace them with grace notes. Like a note of wit to give it style, a note of glitter, a note of guile, a note of tact, a note of friction, a note of fact in amongst the fiction, and to counteract any contradiction, a note or two of complete conviction.
Compose, compose, compose.
Luscious harp, soft hi-hat. If you're sharp, then you won't fall flat. Make the most of the music that is yours. Give it sweep, add a fill. Give the people a great big trill. Make the most of your music till it soars, till it scores.
All right, so a lot of listing there that we have, but what stands out for you?
I'm trying to recall now. What was that first bit?
The very first bit is like your bass notes, erase notes, grace notes. But then he goes in that list of like a note of glitter, a note of guile, et cetera, et cetera, through that list.
Oh, sure. Okay. I like the replacing bass notes with grace notes, or erasing, whatever it is. It's
yeah.
But you can tell sometimes getting carried away there with his rhymes and thinking, oh, I can do this. I can. It's almost like he is Ben at this moment, which is another double irony. He's listing all of the things he can do in terms of, look at all the rhymes I can make, and that it's so like what Ben is singing about. And then it kind of it loses it for me. I think the next bit, the a note of tact in amongst the fiction.
Yeah, a note of tact, a note of friction, a note of fact in amongst the fiction.
I mean, that's clever, and I think I find it annoying because I hear that and I go, yes, that's what Ben is thinking inside, but it's so fleeting and it's so lost against this idea of it being about a song, being about how to write a song, that it doesn't pack as much punch as I think it could. Mm-hmm. Or almost I think that could be the signal for a live, laugh, love moment where he trips up on himself. It's a moment of realization of, oh, I'm lying to myself, but he carries on. Maybe that's more powerful, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think what we're both hitting at here is the fact that Ben is, of course, this character who puts on this, you know, performance, right? Like, I am the rich, pretty important guy, but on the inside, I'm like kind of falling apart. And you kind of see that progression throughout the show. Even though there's not much plot after the first 30 minutes, you kind of still get that idea that Ben is like not as cool as and calm as he may seem. And then in here, I mean, we're getting those comments thrown in. And I guess I should say, maybe the performance that's happening at the same time really hits this home. I would say, though, that the vocal performance just by itself does not convey that he is like being torn up about this. I think he really believes what he's feeling. It sounds like he is convinced and saying all these lines with conviction. And therefore, what it feels like is like, oh, yeah, for sure. This has been like just, you know, grab the world by its horns and ride it, right? But in a music metaphor instead.
I don't really have anything else to add on that. No, you're right.
The only thing that I will say, I believe, if I'm getting my terms correct, I've only taken one course of film studies in my life, but I think they call this Mickey Mousing, is technically what they call it, when you say something and then the music behind you actually does what you're saying. So it happens nice. At the very end here, which is give it a sweep, add a fill, give the people a great big trill. Each one of those three, that actually happens in the music behind him. So there's a little bit of fun with the orchestration that's going on there for sure. So we get into the big finish here. So Ben continues going on now with the chorus and everyone singing with him. Compose, blending the highs with the lows, just so it rises an uptune, upbeat, long as it keeps climbing, upscale, upstreet, everything is timing. Find the blend, set the beat, keep ascending, don't compete, compose. This is where the big dance number happens. And then he comes back. Comes the day pretty soon when you may have to trust your tune. Make the most of the music, and who knows, you may even get to like what you compose.
Compose, bending the highs with the lows. Just so it rises an uptune, upbeat, long as you keep climbing.
The blend, set the beat, keep ascending, don't compete, compose.
So that's how the song ends. I'm going to read just kind of like the footnote of what is supposed to happen at the end of the song, which I don't think feels like it does in the recording. Essentially what's going on in this thing, right? Ben started in front of the curtain, but the curtains eventually part and you get those like that classic, again, 40s musical style of like the big staircase, right? That you can like climb up on and a big platform at the top. So there's dancing, chorus girls dancing, song and dance number. At the very end of this, he's actually reached the very top step. And so the number ends with Ben reaching the highest step, but the key sticks. And out from the bowels of the piano come Sally, Phyllis, and Buddy to help him. Chaos ensues, and then the show ends like you would normally see Follies do. I don't think you get any of that from this recording of like these people climbing out of the piano to like, help him out at the very end, or that even like the keys are starting to stick on the piano at the very end. Like none of that actually happens in the recording.
That's almost grotesque. I'd love to see something like that happen. Yeah, and I think actually and that's also lost in the recording, and that what immediately happens after is it goes back into You're Gonna Love Tomorrow, which seems so perverse. We have this big number and then we're back into You're Gonna Love Tomorrow, when you're right, it's Cameron McIntosh going for the happy ending.
Like that's what it's going on, yeah.
It's Follies with a a lowercase f. It's the, oh, silly us, we're slipping up, which sure is one interpretation of the word, but I don't think it's what they were going for. And I think in these moments with, say, the God, Why Don't You Love Me Blues, which is a funny song, you still in that song see the big mistake that Buddy has made, and you get the double meaning of Follies. Whereas I don't think if that's the case with this song, especially just from hearing it in, on the cast recording, you don't get that extra wham, here's the other meaning of Follies, you punk.
you idiot. It was here the whole time.
It's no, my keys got jammed on the piano. Oh, what are you gonna do? But I do like the final twist in the last word. You might just like what you compose. It's fun that after all that and after all of this, if I take it from a composer perspective, if I do all of this toiling and agonizing, and if I tell myself this song is fine, I might by the end of it actually like it, even though I probably inwardly don't.
Yeah, it definitely ties back to like the road you didn't take earlier in the show, because you know there Ben is always talking about like who's going to remember the Ben that never was, right?
Sure.
It's like hopefully you can make up this story and that you'll actually enjoy your life. Like yeah, definitely I think he's trying to convince himself a little bit here in this final twist, but I don't know if the rest of the music necessarily supports that.
No, and I also, am I right in thinking that Cameron wanted to cut the road you didn't take for the 1987 production?
I think you might be right, actually. I can very quickly check, actually.
I could be completely wrong about that.
You're right, it's not even there. Never mind, you're right. So in the 1987 version, the road you didn't take doesn't exist.
So it must have been replaced with Country House?
Yes, you're right. Yeah, so Country House, but then they also replaced another song with Country House. They really butchered this score in the 1987 version. They really flipped things around.
Well, because there's also that song, was it Who Could Be Blue? Maybe that's, I can't remember. Whatever.
But you're right, yeah. So just quickly checking on the album itself, The Road You Didn't Take does not actually appear in the 1987 version, which you would have already known if you've been listening to the entire season, and I'm just dumb. But I don't know. I find that The Road You Didn't Take packs such a wallop at the end, especially that last little bit. It's like, yes, that is Ben. That is obviously what Ben is. So I think this is maybe something I'm trying to bring that little bit back in here. It just doesn't have that same emotional weight.
Yeah, and I think I would buy Make the Most of Your Music if you did have The Road You Didn't Take, because you've set up the fact that he is so concerned about how he comes across and what he hasn't done with his life. For him to sing a song about, oh, it doesn't matter, then I would feel it in a different way.
I just do also want to mention two lyric changes again in this section. Very, sure. Very minor, but I actually think that they mean completely different things. So there is a short section where he says, like, just so it rises an uptune, upbeat, long as it keeps climbing, is what it's written in the book, Finishing the Hat. But the actual recording says, long as you keep climbing, not as long as it keeps climbing. So I actually like the recording better because it actually, you know, makes it more about the person rather than this, like, general it keeps climbing. But at the very final one, it, like, comes a day pretty soon when you may have to trust your tune. It's comes a day all too soon when you may have to trust your tune. So very minor lyric changes, but they're there. They're a little bit different than what he's written in the actual book itself.
Yeah, and I think I like the reference on the self more. Although what is interesting about this song is that everything is in the second person. It's all about you, what you're doing. Yeah. He never says what I'm
not
doing.
Not me, right.
Yeah. Which is, I guess, one saving virtue about this song is that he doesn't want to admit that it's him, but then it does it removes the effect of the song in a way. I don't know if you feel that, but if he was saying I, or if even if for a line he slipped into me, it would give it more of a
I would hate to say this, though, like if I was to give notes on this song, like who cares? But I mean, that's what I would probably say, is like at least in this final section, having that second person start to flip to like a first person narrative, I think would actually do it. Or even have somehow him use that and try and flip back, but like struggle with like the personal versus the outward face that he's trying to do. I think that would maybe have a little bit more, I don't know, thematic resonance.
But then obviously Sondheim wrote it, so we kind of have to go what he
did. Yeah, sorry. I don't know. Final thoughts on this song. I know we've been fairly critical, but is there any parts of this that you do enjoy?
You can edit out this pause.
He actually just paused for 3 minutes straight. You know, what I'll say, honestly, is that I actually don't mind the song itself. I think there's some interesting musicianship going on here. I just don't think it belongs in Follies. I think that's the issue I have more so than the actual song itself. I just feel like because I know what the original Follies is supposed to be, it's like this is like a B level when there's a better version of this.
Yeah, it's really difficult to like the song on its own or just as an own discrete object when you have Live, Laugh, Love. It is a nice tune, and I think if it were a tiny bit shorter, I would like it on its own. But there are some virtues in the 1987 cast recording in the form of Arba Underneath. I think that's probably the only virtue. And Diana Rigg. Diana Rigg's great. And Julie McKenzie. But then it's so anticlimactic to have that song immediately afterwards with no trajectory or no kind of end point of this is going to leave you going home sad about your life, which is what you want when you see a Sondheim show.
There's no uplifting here. No uplifting. Before you start to write letters, I will say Sondheim agrees with us in that he's not a big fan of the additions into the 1987 production. He actually writes in his book, this is exactly what he writes: "Although none of the new songs was much of an improvement, Country House was too harsh a style for the score. And Loveland was unnecessary, and Make the Most of Your Music was too elaborate and expensive to stage easily." So that's basically what he writes about this song. It's pretty dismissive of it. It's like, everything else works better in the original version of Follies. The only one he will say is like, "Abba Underneath is a good substitute if the actress is not a dancer and can't do the story of Lucy and Jesse. They can just substitute it for this song and it'll still kind of work." But besides that, there's not much that he recommends for these new songs.
I think he's right. And I think your listeners will agree that you and I both are big fans of Sondheim's songs. So us being real nitpickers on this on this episode is we just want the best for him and his shows, I think. And I think if it were any other composer, we probably would be fine with this song. But it's when you're someone who is a stickler for any kind of, you know, discrepancy in your own work, and then you write something like that, I think your fans might have a bone to pick, I suppose.
It's not what you said, Mr. Sondheim, it's how you said it. That's basically what...
Yeah.
Well, Colin, thank you so much for joining me here today. If people wanted to, like, follow you online, see what you're up to, what is the easiest way for them to do that?
I guess primarily they can follow me on Twitter at @ColinMalloy_. I also have a SoundCloud and a YouTube, which I post on occasionally. And actually, I think it might encourage me to get more work out there because I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I don't really like to share stuff until it's really ready. But sometimes it's nice to have an expectant audience just wanting to hear stuff. And I know there are loads of people who are eager to hear new musical theatre. I'm always eager to hear new musical theatre. So yeah, that's where you can find me.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network, to the Calgary Foundation, and to Park Power this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. Next week, we'll be talking about Live, Laugh, Love, three words that no one has used to describe the year 2020. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
Yeah, and then kind of talking a little bit about Ben Psyche and whether or not you think that this works better, worse, or the same as Live, Laugh, Love, which I think I know what your opinion is, but...
Yeah, I think I might know what yours is too, but you might surprise me.